Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22. 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, planets come into view for early morning sky watchers. And the connection between alien life and microbes that live deep in the cracks of undersea volcanoes. Here's a scientist soundbite.
So if you go out right before dawn and just look toward the eastern sky, whether you see any meteors or not, you'll still see the moon near those planets because they are very, very, very bright. And you can see them from the city, from the suburbs, from anywhere on the planet Earth on those mornings. So that will be a beautiful thing to see in the pre-dawn sky, especially after a night of meteor watching.
That's sky watcher Deborah Bird. More with her later, but first, science news of the week with Michael Brennan and Emily Howard.
In the latest State of the Climate report, released by NOAA and the National Climatic Data Center, July 2012 is the warmest month ever recorded in the contiguous United States. Yes, not only the warmest July ever recorded, but the warmest month ever recorded since record-keeping began in 1895. In fact, July 2012 beat the old record set back in July 1936, the same year we experienced record heat and drought during the Dust Bowl.
After NASA's Mars Curiosity rover arrived at the top of Mars's atmosphere on the night of August 5th and 6th, it had just 7 minutes to go from a speed of nearly 14,000 miles per hour, that's 22,000 kilometers per hour, to a soft landing on Mars's surface. Because Mars is currently 150 million miles away from Earth, NASA scientists didn't know if Curiosity landed safely for another 7 minutes after that, the time it took a radio signal to travel between our two worlds. After what NASA scientists dubbed 7 minutes of terror, the Curiosity rover was confirmed to have landed on the surface and began sending back photos from Mars. Our congratulations to the NASA team on an incredible accomplishment and a triumphant moment in modern science. More at earthsky.org.
UK-led researchers have identified skin cancer in a wild fish population for the first time. They found that an unusually high percentage of the fish they caught from islands in Australia's Great Barrier Reef Marine Park had dark skin lesions, reminiscent of human skin cancer. The report was published in the journal PLOS-1 this month.
It's been an active week for tropical cyclones. All three major basins, that's the Western Pacific, Eastern Pacific, and the Atlantic, have had an increase in tropical cyclone activity this past week. The Western Pacific typhoon season has been fairly active as Tropical Storm Haikui pushed into China on August 7th, just south of Shanghai. In the Atlantic, Tropical Storm Ernesto was upgraded to a Category 1 hurricane with sustained winds of 85 miles per hour as it made landfall in the Yucatan Peninsula just north of Belize late on August 7th. Meanwhile, in the eastern Pacific, Tropical Storm Gilma has formed, but it shouldn't be a threat to land. Learn more at earthsky.org. That's our news of the week. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. This week's Song of the Week is by Austin Leonard Jones. It's off his new album, Ponderosa. This song's called Black Cayman.
Thank you.
What is that you're afraid of? When you turn off the light and your life is getting shorter and you're running by the mile, everyone will walk away, every dog will have its day, every day will end in style.
Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird joins us now with news of the global night sky. Meteors and planets come into view. Welcome, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge. I've been in here a couple of times now talking about meteors, and that's because this is the best time of year to watch for meteors from the Northern Hemisphere. So I want to encourage everybody to get out in the next few mornings and watch for meteors. So the Perseid meteor shower, which is the most famous meteor shower in the Northern Hemisphere, is peaking around now. The exact days of the peak are August 11th, 12th, and 13th in the morning. And you always want to watch for meteors in the morning sky, if you can, the sky between midnight and dawn. So those are the peak mornings. If you're hearing this after the peak, you might still see some meteors. But if you can watch on those peak mornings, the mornings of the 11th, 12th, and 13th, that would really be so great because there's something else going on in the morning sky around then. And that is the waning moon is going to be right next to the two brightest planets, Venus and Jupiter.
Awesome. So yeah, tell us more about what's happening in these early mornings here. Meteor shower, planets?
So what you'll see is you'll be outside in the mornings before dawn. And again, this is the morning of the 11th, 12th, and 13th. And I'll talk in a minute about what you'll see if you're hearing us after the 11th, 12th, and 13th. But if you can get out on those mornings, what you'll do is you'll be out at night. You'll be in a wonderful dark location. You'll be seeing meteors fly across the night sky. And then all of a sudden, you'll notice this light coming up in the eastern sky, and it'll be the moon. And you'll be saying to yourself, oh, darn, the moon is rising. So that's going to obscure the view of the meteors. In fact, it won't obscure the view of the meteors that much. You'll still see some meteors in the light of that thin waning crescent moon. But even better than that, you'll see the planets Venus and Jupiter near the moon. So if you go out right before dawn on the 11th, 12th, or 13th and just look toward the eastern sky, whether you see any meteors or not, you'll still see the moon near those planets because they are very, very, very bright and you can see them from the city, from the suburbs, from anywhere on the planet Earth on those mornings. So that will be a beautiful thing to see in the pre-dawn sky, especially after a night of meteor watching.
Awesome. So what if people miss the peak of this meteor shower, August 11th, 12th, 13th? What can people see then?
Well, the Perseid meteor shower rises very gradually to a peak, and it tends to drop off kind of suddenly. So after the meteor shower, you're not going to see nearly as many, after the morning of the 13th, you're not going to see nearly as many meteors as you would have seen, say, in the previous week. However, you might see some meteors, and late summer is a wonderful time to look for what are called random meteors or sporadic meteors. So on any summer night, especially with the moon out of the way, you might see a meteor. What's more, the planets Venus and Jupiter have been in the pre-dawn sky now for a little over a month, and they've been very near each other. They're pulling away from each other now. So if you're hearing us, say, around mid-August, you'll still be able to see Venus and Jupiter in the morning sky. And in fact, if you watch them, you'll be able to see Jupiter pull away from Venus and begin to make its way into the evening sky. Jupiter's going to be in our evening sky by the end of this year. So that'll be something to see, too.
Awesome. And nothing takes the breath away more than just watching the night sky and seeing one of these straggler meteors out there.
That's right. And, you know, they are just, most of them are just little grains of dust that fall into Earth's atmosphere. The meteors in annual showers get left behind by comets. But then some of them are more rocky. So it just depends on, you know, what type of meteor you see. But most of those little things are very, very small. And they make this beautiful streak across the night sky that we call a meteor or shooting star.
Fantastic. Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Scientists are just beginning to understand how life thrives underground, microbes that live in the deep rock and sediments. Pound for pound, the biomass of life underground might be as much as all the plants and animals on Earth's surface. That's according to microbiologist James Holden of the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He's completed a first-ever study with detailed data on microbes that live deep in the cracks of hot undersea volcanoes, hydrothermal vents. These microbes might even give scientists answers to questions about alien life beyond Earth. Dr. Holden published the results in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in August of 2012. He's on the line now to explain his findings. Dr. Holden, welcome.
Thank you.
What are the results of your study on microbes that live deep in the cracks of undersea volcanoes?
Well, some of the important things that we've found as a result of this are... we're very interested in trying to understand where it is in the subsurface that we can find life. And we don't think that we find all life everywhere. And so it becomes a kind of economics question. What, if you think of it in economic terms, how much does the microbe earn from the energy from that environment, and what's its cost of living? And so what we're trying to understand is how much does it cost an organism to live within a particular environment, and how does that relate to the energy that's available? So what we did is we ran some experiments in the laboratory to try and figure out, okay, how much hydrogen does one particular group of organisms need to grow? These organisms are called methanogens. And then we went out into the field, out to hydrothermal vents off the coast of Washington and Oregon, and tested our hypothesis that we generated in the lab, our value, to see if it actually did hold up. And it did. There was one site where there should have been enough hydrogen based on our estimate, and another where there wasn't. And we found methanogens where we thought they should be, and they weren't where we didn't think they would be.
Describe for us how the study was done. How did you study the growth and metabolism of creatures that live in the deep rock of hydrothermal vents?
Okay. So, yes, there are thoughts that there is a tremendous, enormous amount of microbial biomass living within the Earth's crust and in the sediments. Some estimates are that it's about a third of the total biomass. Others have suggested that it may even rival the biomass that's living on the surface of the planet. And so what we did is we used the deep sea research submarine Alvin to go down and collect samples. And we collect rock samples and fluid samples using various devices, large titanium syringes. And we culture organisms from the rocks and from the fluids, and we also do chemical analyses on the fluids. And then we're able to bring some of these microorganisms back into the laboratory, and we can grow them up in a bioreactor that we operate in my laboratory. So we can have temperature control, pH control, we can vary the amount of hydrogen that's in the reactor, and then monitor their growth. So that allowed us to then compare the results that we were getting in the laboratory with those that we were getting out in the field.
Why are scientists studying microbes that live at deep-sea hydrothermal vents?
Well, there's a variety of reasons. For one thing, we don't know very much about how carbon flows in the deep ocean. Who fixes it? How does it get fixed? Where does carbon that rains down from the surface go? What is its ultimate fate? And so there's a lot of interest in just being able to model the biogeochemistry and the carbon flux that exists in the deep ocean. This study also is important because it helps us to understand environments that are independent, free of sunlight and oxygen. So the organisms that we study don't require these compounds. And so it helps us to understand what life may have been like, say, on the early Earth 3 billion years ago, or what life might even be like beyond Earth.
What's the connection between alien life, life beyond our planet, and your research with these microbes?
So we are interested in these organisms, as I said, that do not require sunlight and do not require any oxygen, yet they're able to take carbon dioxide and turn it into organic carbon. And they do this using carbon and energy sources that are derived from the inside of the Earth, from volcanic activity and just water rock reactions. We think that if there is life, say, on Mars or on Europa, then it's going to be similar sorts of life, life that's independent of sunlight and independent of oxygen. So by understanding the life and the constraints on the life that lives in these hydrothermal environments, it gives us some idea of what we could expect, say, on these other planets and how we might be able to model this life using computer models. And that way, have a good idea of, well, if we do look for life on Mars, where should we look for it? And what should we be looking for based on what we know on life that's here in similar environments on Earth?
The environments on Mars and the moon Europa seem very different than that found at hydrothermal vents, or are they?
Well, we think that there was past hydrothermal vent activity on Mars, and there may still be some hydrothermal activity on Mars today. We don't really know. So it's possible that there still is water circulating in the crust of Mars that's being driven by a heat source and has some gas coming to it, or that this certainly happened in the past. Likewise, too, with the Jovian moon Europa, even though it's completely covered in an ice shell, we think that there's liquid water underneath that ice, and because of what's called tidal flexing, where the moons get squished back and forth because of the gravitational pull of Jupiter and the other moons, we think that there's a lot of volcanic activity on Europa. And so there, because there's liquid water and there's volcanic activity, there may be hydrothermal vents deep below the ice on Europa as well. So actually studying life associated with hydrothermal environments is applicable to both Europa and to Mars.
What are these places like, the hydrothermal vents where microbes inhale hydrogen and carbon dioxide and exhale methane?
So what happens is, especially along the seams of the plates of the Earth, where new ocean floor is being formed, there's a very shallow heat source, and the rock is very fractured, has a lot of cracks in it. And so what happens is that seawater percolates down through these cracks, comes into contact with hot rock, and it reacts. It loses some chemicals, and it gains others as a result of reacting with the rock. And then what happens is that the superheated water, it can be heated up to temperatures of, say, well, over 400 degrees centigrade, will rise up because it's buoyant, and it'll come shooting out of the ocean floor as these very dramatic black jets that we call black smokers. And what happens is that this fluid, as it comes out, it also mixes with some seawater, very shallow. And so even though the fluid that's coming out of the seafloor may be 400 degrees, it's mixing with some seawater, and it creates an environment between the upper temperature limit of life, which we think is about 120 degrees, all the way down to seawater temperatures. And it's this mixture of this hydrothermal fluid and the seawater that creates a habitat or an environment that can support different types of life. And so what we're interested in is the higher temperature life that's living in the absence of oxygen in this mixture of seawater and hydrothermal fluid that's actually inside the rock, inside basalt and inside metal sulfide deposits that are associated with these hydrothermal environments.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about life at deep sea hydrothermal vents?
Well, it's that life is remarkably flexible, especially microbial life. It is capable of metabolizing all sorts of things that we can even hardly dream of, consuming different types of gases and reacting with metals and rocks and all sorts of things. And so what hydrothermal vents do is they really give us an opportunity to really explore and understand just how diverse life is and how it is that life can live in really extreme conditions and extreme environments, and really broaden the window or the limits of life. And from that, it helps us to understand the primary principles of how life functions. And from that, it opens up to all sorts of possibilities in terms of medicine, technology, the search for life elsewhere, if we can understand those basic principles of how life operates.
You've been listening to microbiologist James Holden. That's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at Earth Sky Studio B in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Austin Leonard Jones, Sleep Good, 100 Flowers, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.